Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher, 8:06 on this Monday morning. It's May 16th. Currently, we've got 50 degrees here in Old Town Park City. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Thomas Giboy. Good morning.
Morning, Leslie. Happy Monday. Hope that your week is off to a good start. And doesn't seem like that long ago we were talking about 50s for a daytime high. It was a warm weekend, and we're going to carry that warmth over into today in Park City, where we're going to find a daytime high of 77 degrees. So if you like the warmth, we got more of it in store for today. We'll get partly cloudy to partly sunny skies. But as we go from this afternoon into the evening, there will be a small chance for an isolated thunderstorm. Can't be completely ruled out now. I think in Park City, that chance is probably around 10%, so not all that high. But it is something to keep an eye on as we go from late this afternoon into the evening, especially with the daytime heating. And then as we go into tonight, we go back to partly cloudy skies with an overnight low dropping to 49 degrees. I do think for our Tuesday, there'll be a slightly better chance for some thunderstorms, mainly high-based, so they might not produce that much moisture if we're able to find one, but about a 1 in 3 chance for some isolated thunderstorms in northern Utah. Otherwise, it's going to be a little bit cooler thanks to a little bit more of a westerly flow compared to a southerly flow like we're having now. Partly sunny with a chance with that chance for thunderstorms, a daytime high of 69 degrees, and then we'll be a little bit cooler Tuesday night as we drop to 43 degrees, keeping that partly cloudy sky throughout the overnight hours, as that chance for thunderstorms will then begin to dwindle. But again, that chance for thunderstorms not all that high in the first place. Then for our Wednesday, we're going to be looking at sunny skies, a daytime high of 70 degrees, so a beautiful day for our Wednesday. But then going from Wednesday night into Thursday, got a cold front that's going to be on the way. The daytime high on Thursday only going to be climbing to 58 degrees under a partly sunny sky. And then from Thursday night into Friday, we're going to have a chance of rain and snow. On Thursday night, the overnight low dropping to 27 degrees. So we're going to go on a little bit of a temperature seesaw here coming up as we go into the second half of the work weekend. On Friday, a slight chance of rain and snow showers, that best chance looking like it's going to be during the first half of the day, because we'll eventually find a daytime high of around 51 degrees. Then as we go into Friday night, the chance of any wet weather looks like it's going to move away, the overnight low dropping to 31. And then for both Saturday and Sunday, we're going to see mostly sunny skies in Park City. Daytime high on Saturday will be in the upper 50s at 59 degrees, climbing, only dropping to 39 degrees on Saturday night. Then we're back in the middle 60s on Sunday. So after a little bit unsettled end to the work week, we should get calmer skies and fairly pleasant temperatures for the upcoming weekend.
Okay, Thomas, thank you.
You're welcome.
It's 8:09. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. We'll stay tuned coming up. I'll be talking this morning with Park City Leadership founder Miles Radiman. He'll have a preview of this year's annual city tour that leaves on Wednesday after a two-year COVID-19 hiatus. Then Youth Sports Alliance Executive Director Emily Fisher with an update on the youth sports programs and their recognition from the Aspen Institute. Finally, writer-producer Mary Teege and director Matt Smiley talking about their film For Love. That'll be screened at the Jim Santee Auditorium on Thursday. The film documents the atrocities of the Canadian federal government on its First Nation population. Coming up now on 8:11, good morning. Hundreds of people gathered in City Park Saturday to support abortion rights. KPCW's Carolyn Murray was there. She has this report.
2, 4, 6, 8, abortion bans discriminate.
2, 4, 6, 8, abortion bans discriminate.
On May 2nd, a draft Supreme Court opinion was leaked indicating the court would overturn Roe v. Wade, which would repeal a woman's right to have an abortion. Planned Parenthood Association of Utah responded by organizing three rallies across the state, including one in Park City Saturday. Three local elected leaders, Summit County Council Member Melina Stevens, Park City Council Member Becca Gerber, and Park City's first woman mayor, Nan Worrell, spoke. Park City Mayor Nan Worrell said she understands the issue is political, but she takes it personally.
I'm speaking today as a woman who is deeply offended that a hard-fought ruling that has stood for nearly 50 years is anticipated to be overturned and set back the health and rights of American women.
Previously, Worrell was executive director of the People's Health Clinic, where her job required her to report underage pregnancies to the state.
I have sat at my desk and wept as I have had to call Child Protective Services to report the pregnancy of a 13-year-old, a 14-year-old, or a 15-year-old. It breaks my heart. It shouldn't happen.
Members of the Park City Teen Council took the stage and explained the organization's role as a peer-to-peer sex education resource. Park City High School senior Carly McAleer said if the Supreme Court overturns Roe, the U.S. will become a place where the values of a few will impact the well-being and lives of every individual.
A fundamental right for all should be learning about their bodies and having autonomy to make decisions concerning their health and sexual freedom. Abortion rights are a women's only issue, we then make abortion and reproductive freedom a trans exclusive issue where we don't recognize our queer friends and family, and we don't recognize the rights to their bodies and their ability to make decisions about what they can do and who they can be with.
14-year-old Evan is taking a social justice class at Treasure Mountain Junior High School. He attended the rally with his family. He plans to use the experience for a school project, but said he wants to continue attending rallies while he waits to turn 18. Then he said he'll use his voice at the ballot box.
I'm here because I think it's a really important cause, and I think women's rights is just a really important subject.
The attendees included an older set, grandmothers, who showed up half a century ago when the Supreme Court upheld abortion rights in the Roe v. Wade decision. Longtime resident, mother, and grandmother Linda McReynolds said she, like many people her age, is angry.
I'm here protesting today because I did this 50 years ago, and this is settled law. All four justices that seem to now suddenly be against this this right that we women have all lied then under oath because they all said, yes, this is settled law.
Two friends arrived, one dressed as Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the other a handmaid from the TV series. They both have plans to continue their activism if the court strikes down Roe.
I plan to assist females in states where it is not legal by offering my vehicle and myself and my finances to take them to states where they can be and receive the care they need. And I've semi-stockpiled some Plan B while it's still legal and available.
Dr. Tanya Bogdan brought her medical perspective and told the crowd she loves her work as an obstetrician and gynecologist.
It's my job to take care of women and women's health. It's my honor to carry out my duties with love, with patience, and with sensitivity. So it's with a heart full of love when I say, I believe in nothing as much as I believe in safe access to women's health care.
Many Park City police officers and some from other jurisdictions were at the rally. There were no signs of any counter-protesters. Carolyn Murray, KPCW News.
It's 8:15 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Well, after a two-year COVID hiatus, city and county leaders, along with members of Leadership Class 28 and a few stragglers from Classes 26 and 27, will climb aboard the bus Wednesday morning as the annual city tour returns for business. On the phone with details about this year's destination is the founder of Leadership Park City, Miles Rademan. Good morning, Miles.
Good morning, Leslie.
So start by talking about the fact that you've been doing this, I think, in Park City, well, for 28 years now, and I think, what, some 15, 20 years before that?
Oh, no, I've been doing it in Park City 35 years, and we've just invited the leadership class when we started that 28 years ago, but I have been doing it. It would have been my 50th year, but we had 2 years off for COVID, so this is the 48th tour I'm actually organizing.
Wow. Okay. So why are these road trips important, and I guess important especially now to the leadership program?
Well, I like to start out with the idea that a lot of people face the same issues that we face in these resort towns, and especially here in Park City. So we're not the only people facing parking problems and affordable housing problems, sustainability problems, tourism. And so, I think we have to approach our problems with a sense of humility and recognize that other communities have smart people in them too, and people who are dedicated to trying to solve these problems. And it's always good to look at what someone else is doing and maybe be inspired by them or pick up an idea that we could implement here in Park City, or maybe see something that we say that doesn't seem to work and make sure that we try to avoid it. So I guess it's just a learning experience and approaching the world with a sense of humility that we're not always the sharpest knife in the drawer or the brightest bulb on the tree, and there are other people who are also clever and trying to solve problems.
Yeah. So you and I think, what, some 60 others are taking off to where on Wednesday?
Yeah, so on Wednesday morning, bright and early, actually, we'll leave no later than 8 a.m. So we're going to first go up through Twin Falls, but on our way to Boise, Idaho. And in Twin Falls, we're going to meet with the mayor and some of the folks there and learn a little bit about what they're trying to do with agriculture, actually. Pretty interesting. But then we'll spend most of the two nights in Boise, which is a much larger city, but is, I believe, the fastest growing city in the Western United States at this point. So facing tremendous growth pressures. And interestingly enough, I had taken the group there in 2008 and then again in 12 or 14. So it's been a long time since we've been there. Although I've been there a couple times since then. But again, they're a much larger city. I think they have well over a quarter of a million people in that general area now. And it's become a major hub, a little bit like Boulder, let's say, Colorado, or even Denver. And Salt Lake, of course, is doing it, so, you know, growing at that rate. So it's good to see what, you know, a larger city, what they're facing, because in many ways, Park City is kind of a hybrid city now. You know, I used to think of it as purely kind of a recreation community or lifestyle community, but being so close to Salt Lake, we're kind of a hybrid between a much larger city and a small city like some of the resorts in Colorado.
Yeah, and then from Boise, you're headed to
Sun Valley. So we'll spend two nights in Boise, and then we're going to head and stay over in Ketchum, Sun Valley, but we're going to also go through Haley and Bellevue in Idaho, and each of them are doing, you know, they're in different places on the continuum of growth. So some of these places are earlier on in their growth trajectory, but they have clever ideas. They're doing some things that we're not doing here in Bellevue, Washington, which is on the way to Ketchum. We're going to stop and have lunch, actually, at the Hunger Coalition. They're doing a whole lot there about feeding the poor and feeding those who are, we have the Christian Center here that's trying to do some of those things, too. But they really have set up an impressive program in Bellevue that I think is well worth looking at. And then we'll be going on through Haley, which has become kind of a bedroom community to Ketchum Sun Valley, a little bit like Down Valley and the Aspen Valley, you know, and maybe what we're seeing in some of our outlying communities. And then we'll be spending time in Ketchum and Sun Valley, which are very much like Park City in many ways, but without having the large metropolitan area close by. So they're going to roll out the red carpet for us and tell us everything they're doing, and hopefully we'll be able to share some of the things we're doing with them.
Yeah, so since you've been on all of these tours, I mean, what do you look for as you kind of return to these locations? I mean, do you see much change and different personalities, I'm guessing?
Yeah, you definitely see different personalities. Usually I try to wait about 10 years before we revisit a community, mostly because they forget how much trouble it is of hosting us. So I wait for our new cast of characters to be there. But they've always shown great hospitality. Every place we've gone over the 48 years I've done this has shown great hospitality because people do like to tell their story, just like we like to tell our story here. And so over the years, we've seen some things. Like, for instance, people always say, well, you know, what do you get out of it? What's the take-home pay? Why are you doing this? Well, many of the things that we have instituted here, we've seen somewhere else. We didn't invent everything. We've invented some things, you know, but for instance, when we did the land trusts, we saw those land trusts first in places like Jackson. And because of what we saw in Jackson, we were able to, you know, have the two land trusts here in Utah start. the rail trail. We saw that in the Wood River Valley, which is where Ketchum is. That's where we learned about rail trail conversions when we did our rail trail conversion here. So that's a long time ago now. That's almost 30-some years ago when we visited there. Affordable housing, we saw that in Aspen, and we saw how they were doing it, and that really sparked some of the ideas here. 1% for public arts. We saw that down in New Mexico when we visited Tintajos and Santa Fe. So I'm just giving you an example. You know, there are things that other places, depending on where you are in the trajectory of growth and development, some people have already tried some things that have seemed to work, and we can be inspired by those. It's dangerous, too, though, to think that you can just see something somewhere else and just helicopter it in here and drop it in, it's going to work. You have to see if the culture here matches sort of the culture there. And in some ways it does, in some ways it doesn't. Some things probably wouldn't work here. But, you know, we always learn something, I could tell you that. And we always have something to teach, and I think that's valuable, too. Another big reason for the tour, though, is to create our own community. We're all so busy now that, you know, you get 60 people to go somewhere for 5 days. And communities are always amazed that we do get 60 people or more to go somewhere for 5 days together. It speaks a lot about Park City, that people are willing to take the time and the energy and spend the money, really, to go visit someplace that's going to learn. And so there's magic in numbers. You know, if one person sees a good idea, it's hard to convince everyone else. But if 60 people see a good idea and talk about it, and you get a nucleus for action. And so there is strength in numbers.
Yeah. So have we ever reciprocated? I mean, have we seen some of these towns come back and visit Park City?
Well, we have. Not in great numbers, you know, because people, again, are always, they think it's kind of a magic. You know, how could you get 60 people to go away for 5 days? I always hear that. And I said, well, it's really not magic. You just get a bus, you know, a couple vans, you go. But, yeah, we've had Breckenridge come here, and the whole thing with the Colorado Association of Ski Towns, when we joined that, that was an outgrowth. That's how I started the city tours, actually, when we started, when I lived in Colorado in Crested Butte, when the mayor and I, way back in 1972, started the Colorado Association of Ski Towns. We started going on trips to other ski towns, and that turned into that. But, you know, we're seeing things, for instance, like about the sustainability and climate change and what's going on. That's kind of an outgrowth of this kind of thing, of this general sharing amongst communities of interest. I mean, why is there like a National Association of Governors or things of that nature? I mean, there are certain commonalities that it pays to share your experience, because sometimes you can short circuit making a lot of bad mistakes.
Yeah, so it sounds like a jam-packed schedule. I mean, anything or anyone in particular that you're looking forward to hearing from?
Well, when you mentioned the jam-packed schedule, I'm a little nervous about the schedule, quite frankly, because I put this together with a good friend of mine, Wendy Jaquit, who was the head of the Ketchum Sun Valley Chamber for many years, then and spent 18 years in the Idaho legislature as a minority leader. She was so anxious to help putting this together with me that she got so many speakers, and I kept saying, can we really hear from that many people? But she's convinced that we can, and I trust her judgment. So we are going to get a fire hose of information here. I have a feeling that we're going to have emergency services when we return to get us off the bus. I think our brains are going to be fried.
Yeah. So, I mean, what is it that you hope the leadership class gets out of it?
Well, you know, quite frankly, what I hope the leadership class gets out of it, and I think this every year, is this is a mixture of the leadership class along with city council members, county council members, and so we're creating community internally. A lot of the people who end up running for city or county council have been in the leadership program. They've kind of seen how this works, and this is a great introduction to them. So I really hope that we inspire some of the people who are in the program this year to, number one, you know, meet other people who are in office and doing the hard work. I also hope that a couple of the ideas that maybe they come up with or which they see on the tour, that they will form a nucleus and say, oh, we should try this idea, or we should try that idea. And we don't force that in any way. I mean, we don't go there to say, we're doing this so that you'll run for council, or we're doing this so you'll start a nonprofit. But, you know, many of those things have come out of these trips. It's kind of organic the way that works. So I don't know what'll take root. I mean, again, you know, I've done this for a long time, and I've been amazed, quite frankly, of some of the things that have come out of this, and things that I didn't expect at all.
Yeah.
And so I think we'll be surprised.
It looks like the mayor, all but one city council member, is going.
Actually, he's going as well. He rearranged his schedule, and he's going to join us as well.
Okay.
So we have our entire city council going.
Mayor, city manager, we've got somebody from the communications team, the special events director. The city taxpayers absorb those costs?
Generally, they do. You know, each of the departments has their own budget for travel and for learning. They usually take that out of that budget there. And the leadership people, they each pay their own way. And that's how it works, yes.
And then what about those joining from Summit County?
Summit County, I guess, you know, they probably do the same thing. They probably have their own travel budgets that they pay. You know, we try to, you'll never do these trips cheaper than I get it, because number one, we've got a lot of things, we get group rates, of course, but we also have a lot of things that are being donated to us. That's what I mean about hospitality. That always floors me as well. And, you know, of course, we're in the hospitality business ourselves, and we did host the Olympics, and hopefully we'll host another one. But, people are giving us dinners and coffees and lunches and so forth. So you'll never get an insider's view of these communities for less money than we're going to do it right now on Wednesday.
Yeah. And as we mentioned up front, you know, there was a two-year hiatus, and you invited... What, some members of the class?
No, we invited them all. You know, we made the pledge that we would invite. Yeah, we couldn't go for class 26 and 27. We had to cancel the tour, which was unfortunate. But we did invite them, and we do have one member from class 26, and we have about seven people, I think, from class 27 joining us on this tour.
So you would have taken two buses if people had...
No, you know, quite frankly, in the last number of years before this, we got canceled, I was taking about 70 people, and our host this year said, oh, you can't bring that many people up here, it's too many for us. So, you know, I put it out there to these other classes that they'll be invited every year if they want, we'll try to, anyone who wants to go. And it's usually, you know, once you've been through the program and your life goes on to other things, and, you know. But they'll be invited.
And what about anybody from Wasatch County joining you?
No. No one from Wasatch County is joining us at this point. They do have their own leadership program. And I know I'll be stopping over at the Wasatch Back Economic Summit on Wednesday. I know they've called me. And in the past, we've had one or two people from... Well, I shouldn't say this. Some of the people in the leadership program live in Wasatch County. Actually, one-third of our program now does not live in Park City, so they live in the general area, but I call it the greater Park City area, or the Wasatch Back area, however you want to refer to it now. But I think maybe we'll see more intergroup cooperation as the years go on, because I know that's a big point for the council now.
Okay. Anything else you'd like to tell us about it?
No, I think it'll be good when we come back if we could talk on the radio and say, here's what we learned, because we always do a debriefing. That's a very important part of the program. On Sunday, right before we return, we sit down for an hour and a half and we say, okay, what did we see? What did we like? What didn't we like? Are there ideas that we can implement back here in Park City? And then we try to put together a brief report, and I try to report back to both the city councils and the county council and the Chamber Bureau, and we have Jennifer Westloff from the Chamber joining us on this year's tour. So we try to, you know, and we try to get on the radio and be interviewed in the paper and say, here's what we learned, and maybe some of the things can be implemented here.
Okay. Hey, Miles, thanks for your time this morning.
My pleasure, Leslie. Thank you.
That's the founder of Leadership Park City, Miles Radiman. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Well, joining me now in the studio, I have the Executive Director of the Youth Sports Alliance, Emily Fisher. Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's first mention that Youth Sports Alliance was named as a Project Play Champion by the Aspen Institute. What does that mean?
We were really excited to get this award. The Aspen Institute has a lot of different areas where they concentrate. One of them is called Project Play, and it's really focused on how can we look differently at youth athletics, especially post-COVID. They did a lot of stuff during COVID. Prior to COVID, they always have a Project Play Summit. They bring together leaders in youth sports, talk about how we can make it more affordable, more accessible, look at the differences between lower economic, higher economic youth, who's participating in sports. We have attended the Project Play Summit. It's really interesting. They have panel speakers. They have different athletes who've gone through different phases of life come in. Tom Ferries runs that, and it's fascinating. So we have put our hat in the ring for a couple of years. They're very, they promote sports sampling, which is something that we do extensively. So we've applied for this award a couple times, and we're just really thrilled to be recognized nationally for our work in the sports sampling and getting youth into different sports.
That's what they were looking at? I mean, specifically sports sampling, or I mean, what is it that you had to do?
Yeah, specifically sports sampling, but also a new initiative. And so for us, that was expanding into the more rural areas of the county. So Camas, South Summit, Heber, South Summit Academy, Wasatch. So sort of our initiative to spread into those areas, and that's what we were awarded the Project Play Champion for.
Okay, congratulations on that then.
Thank you.
Let's see, you've got the final programs of the school year underway.
Yeah, we are wrapping up our school year. We run those after school programs from September to May. This year we had a large increase in participation, which was great. And part of that was because we have expanded into now 22 local schools. So we're going to be just under 2,200 students participating in our programs, which is a 40% jump in last year, a 30% jump in our largest year ever. So we have had a lot of students out trying a lot of new things this year.
Great. And is that as big as it can get?
Well, I don't think so. I think obviously we'll have to get Heather Sims and her staff some additional help. We will be looking to hire somebody part-time in Wasatch, concentrating on that area. I think we continue, there is capacity out there for us, and so I think we can continue to grow.
Yeah. And it seems like a lot of it was early on focused on the winter sports, but you're really trying to
Yeah, it really started. I mean, that's kind of our signature people. That's how people got to know us, was through our winter sports. But now we run those sports from, like I said, from September to May. And I think as our community gets more focused on other sports, there are other opportunities. There's also just a lot of really cool new opportunities, new businesses out there. We partner with Rise Boxing, Bow Collective, the Sailing Club, the Dance Studios, so many art, different things to do in the community. I mean, there's glass blowing, there's the Kimball Arts Center. So there's just a lot of opportunities. We just want youth to try as many new things as possible, try to find their passion, do it in bite-sized classes, figure out what they're passionate about.
And it's, so it's not just all about athletics then?
No, it's really about healthy lifestyles. So we have found that once you get to that middle school, students are either participating in a sport full-time, and on their early release day, they might want to try something that they don't always have time for, like an art class or a cooking class, something like that. Or they've dropped out of sports completely, and so we look at the later entry sports, rowing, luge, skeleton, sailing, curling, things like that. Really just trying to get youth interested in something that's good for them, get them off their couch, off their screen, trying something new.
All right. And then last time we talked, you announced the Jim Gaddis Endowment. You've named this for a longtime supporter of the Alliance.
Yes, Jim is an incredible supporter. He was one of our founders. We are thrilled to launch this endowment in his honor. Our initial goal was $2 million, and we're really excited. We're about 1.1, so we're over halfway there, which is great. And this endowment will provide consistent funding to those after-school programs. We'd love to lower the cost for all students and provide more scholarships. And transportation is a critical part of our programming. We're one of the only after-school programs that provides that transportation. Unfortunately, transportation costs continue to increase. But when we provide transportation, we find that our scholarship rate is about 1 in 5, so 20% of the students For those programs that we don't provide transportation, it's about 1 in 19. So families that have two working parents or their family is can't leave during the middle of the day to get the kids to programming, that is a really critical component. So this endowment will address that and can provide that consistent funding.
Yeah. So how does this differ from the Stein-Erickson Endowment Fund?
That's a great question. I'm really glad you asked it. So the Stein-Erickson Endowment provides scholarships to athletes who participate in our 7 winter sport clubs. So they have to be part of one of those clubs, and it is for their programming fees at those clubs. So programming fees, travel, and training. The Jim Gaddis Endowment will be about supporting our after-school programs. So the idea is if a student tries get out and play luge, hopefully the Jim Gaddis Endowment can help support all those after-school programs and students trying all different kinds of things. I think it's critical that all of the students in our community feel included in our community, and part of that is winter sports and mountain biking and trying all of those new things. So that's the Jim Gaddis Endowment. They try luge, they love luge, they join the luge club, and if they can't afford the program fees through the Wasatch Luge Club travel and training, they can apply for the Stein-Erickson Endowment, and we will provide a scholarship. So the idea is really to provide consistent funding for that student all the way through the pipeline.
Yeah, sounds like you got something for everyone now.
Yes, we do.
Okay, hard to believe we're talking about Jan's winter welcome, but you've got the date scheduled and
yes,
an update there.
I know it's will be our 42nd annual Jan's winter welcome, if you can believe it. So the best way to welcome in winter is with Jan's winter welcome, and that will be October 29th at Stein-Erickson Lodge. So excited for that event. We're working on our opportunity drawing package, but ticket sales and table sales will go on sale in July.
Well, and as you likely know, Lindsay Vaughn has moved her annual fundraiser to Park City, that after hosting it in Vail for many years. Do you think that'll have any impact on what you do with Jan's Winter Welcome?
I don't think so. We've, you know, spoken with Lindsay. We've spoken with Laura Kildow, who's the executive director of that foundation, trying to see, you know, potentially how we could collaborate, how we could work together. I think our organizations kind of focus on separate things, but also I really see opportunities to collaborate in the future. We're excited to support that fundraiser here, and hopefully they'll support Jan's Winter Welcome in the fall.
So have they kind of committed to staying in that spring time frame?
You know, I think this is the first year that they've moved their fundraiser here to Park City, so I think they've done a great job of coming into the community and seeing where there are good months to have fundraisers. Obviously, fall is really busy with Red Apple and Jan's and Image Reborn and those different fundraisers. So I think they've done a good job of being a great community partner and community player and seeing where they can fit in the community.
Okay. Anything else, Emily?
I think that's it. I just wanted to say a thank you to Mike Gore. Mike was at Park City when I started at Youth Sports Alliance, then obviously left and came back. He's always been a great supporter of the Youth Sports Alliance. He's a former board member of the Youth Sports Alliance. And I just wanted to thank him for personally and professionally always supporting Youth Sports Alliance and wish him the best on his next journey.
Okay. Emily, we'll see you next month. Thank you.
Thank you.
Emily Fisher is the Executive Director of the Youth Sports Alliance. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. It's 8:42. Good morning. The Park City Council selected a tunnel as the preferred method of getting pedestrians and bikers across Kearns Boulevard at the intersection with State Route 224. KPCW's Sean Higgins has more on that.
The Park City Council was presented with two options for a pedestrian crossing of Kearns Boulevard near the intersection with State Route 224 on Thursday: bridge or tunnel. Neither option is cheap, with the project estimated to cost the city at least $12.4 million, no matter what the council chooses. At the end of the discussion, the proposal to build a pedestrian tunnel beneath Kearns at Snow Creek Drive emerged as the preferred option. Current estimates put the cost for a tunnel at roughly $13.5 million, but the consensus from the council was that there would not be much of an appetite from the public for a large bridge blocking views and looming over traffic. $4.5 million for the project comes from the remaining funds left in the $15 million walkability bond passed by Park City voters in 2007. The remaining funds can come from a mix of federal grants and the city's budget. The Kearns and 224 intersection has been a target for pedestrian improvements for years, and the council decided to pursue an enhanced pedestrian crossing last winter. Bo Pitkin lives in Prospector and is a member of the committee of residents that helps advise the city on walkability projects. He said he also prefers a tunnel to a bridge at the State Route 224 intersection.
I don't want to speak on behalf of the group, but for myself, the tunnel at the high school and the tunnel at Comstock have been very successful, and the tunnel under Bonanza. So I would like to see the continuity of tunnels continue. I don't care for the aesthetics of what a bridge would look like there. I also find that people, pedestrians, are going to be more likely to go down first than to go up first.
Councillor Max Doyle added that although a bridge may be cheaper by about $1 million, he thinks the savings could easily be erased by aesthetic upgrades to make the bridge look more appealing.
I'm with the tunnel program as well. I think that the bridge is going to potentially present problems. I think we'll end up with public feedback. They're not going to like, you know, one person's not going to like the way it looks, another person is, and before you know it, that $1 million that just came off is right back in there for aesthetics, and I think then some, most likely. So from a design perspective, I think the bridge just, it kind of sets us up for a lot more conflict than the benefit.
In addition to pursuing a pedestrian tunnel under Kearns, the council also directed city staff to explore improvements to the existing crosswalks at the intersection. Councillor Becca Gerber said any improvements there would have to go through the Utah Department of Transportation.
Maybe some additional methods to make it a safer pedestrian crossing. I know that those are both UDOT-controlled roads, so we have to reach out to UDOT and kind of get their best recommendation. Overall, we believe the safest crossing is one where you're separating pedestrians from motorists, and there's a separate grade so that it wouldn't negate the need for a tunnel further down the road.
Going forward, city staff will further refine the design of the tunnels. In addition to a tunnel under Kearns, current plans include underground crossings of Snow Creek Drive and the entrance to the Holiday Village parking lot. The council said it also wants to see alternate plans that only go underneath Kearns. The tunnel under Kearns Boulevard will return to the council later this summer. City staff have said the earliest construction could begin is spring 2023. Sean Higgins, KPCW News.
8:45, good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. We've got 53 degrees currently in Old Town Park City. Forecast today calling for partly sunny skies. Expected to get warm up to about 77. Again, some clouds tonight. 49 is the overnight low. Cooling off as that cold front kind of makes its way into the northern Utah here. 30% chance of a shower and thunderstorm afternoon, otherwise partly sunny, and cooling off to about a high of 69. We're back to sunshine and 70 on Wednesday with more unsettled weather at the end of the week. 54 degrees in the Heber Valley. Again, looking for partly sunny skies there with a high of 83. A Heber Valley's nonprofit is holding a conference to support people caring for Alzheimer's and dementia patients. KPCW's Ben Lasseter has more about the organization and its inaugural event.
Katie Blanche, organizer of the Midway Thanksgiving Turkey Trot and Summer House Farms Pumpkin Patch, is gearing up for a new event. Her Linden Legacy Foundation will host a caregivers conference May 20th and 21st for people taking care of Alzheimer's and dementia patients. Because caregivers can be inexperienced with the challenges of patient care, she says it's meant to offer resources to an underserved group.
Our mission of the caregiver conference is to connect caregivers and let them know they are not alone. You know, sometimes it's direct support and you're taking care of the patient, and sometimes it's helping to support the decisions of the primary caregiver. We have resources. There are people that can help and make you feel better and help you with your grief.
The conference is Friday and Saturday from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. in the Blanche Family Education Center at Alta View Hospital in Sandy. The Linden Foundation's name comes from the names Marsden and Lynn. Lynn Blanche is Marsden Blanche's wife and Katie Blanche's mother, as well as an Alzheimer's patient. The conference will feature keynote speaker Dr. Kara Dassel of the University of Utah's Gerontology Interdisciplinary Program, speaking about embracing the present and preparing for the future. Other speakers will cover the clinical side of the disease, the effects of music on the brain, helpful practices, and legal issues caregivers should be aware of. Some workshops will cover healthy dwelling spaces and grooming for loved ones. Laura Wall is the Director of Development for the Alzheimer's Association. That association's a conference partner, as well as the organizer of the annual Walk to End Alzheimer's for Summit and Wasatch Counties. Wall says she's glad to have another local nonprofit helping the cause.
we all work together. This disease is too big for any one nonprofit to tackle. As their foundation continues to grow, they'll focus more on things that we at the Alzheimer's Association don't do.
The Alzheimer's Association's walking fundraiser happens August 13th. It's already raised thousands toward its $170,000 goal, and registrations open at alz.org. Tickets to the upcoming Caregivers Conference cost $20. For those who don't attend, the foundation will post portions of speeches online afterward. Visit lindenlegacy.com, spelled L-Y-N-D-E-N. Ben Lasseter, KPCW News.
Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, coming up Thursday night at the Jim Santee Auditorium, Park City Film presents the screening of For Love, a film that was written and produced by Mary Teege and directed by Matt Smiley. Both of them join me now on the phone. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, Mary, why don't we start with you and tell us why you wanted to make this film?
I think it really was important to really show the length of the impacts of colonization, the impact, more specifically, the impacts of residential school, and to show the length of the high rates of Indigenous children in care in Canada. Not only to show the rates of the reasons why, but also I think it was really important to show how our people are still so resilient and how culture is so important in preventing Indigenous children going into care.
So give us the backstory here. I mean, what we're hearing is that it's been declared a humanitarian crisis as a result of the Canadian federal government. Basically, I don't know, ethnic cleansing, I suppose. I mean, it sounds like they wanted to wipe out the culture of Canada's First Nation populations.
Well, I think when you look at there was a long process of reconciliation where Indigenous people were interviewed and they were told their stories about being in residential school. From that came a report called the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. You'll remember such process happened in South Africa, the Reconciliation Initiative. So this is basically the same what happened in Canada. In the Truth and Reconciliation calls to action, it was there were many recommendations. One of these pieces of that recommendations were around Indigenous child welfare, what needed to happen, that children needed to stop going into care. There also was another recommendation report called the Calls for Justice, which looked at missing Indigenous women and girls. In that, what happened in Canada is called cultural genocide. So for certain, all of the different realms of colonization and residential school, definitely there was the intent to assimilate and to wipe out the Indigenous people through forced assimilation policies, through forced residential school policies, and then and of course in the United States you call it the boarding schools, but it was illegal to not allow your children to attend residential school, so it definitely was a form of cultural genocide.
Yeah. So what's your personal experience with the situation? I mean, were you a part of this assimilation, or you know somebody that was pulled from their home and put into one of these schools?
I will always say that there's not one person that can claim they're an Indigenous Canada that hasn't been impacted by a residential school. In fact, there isn't one Canadian citizen that hasn't been impacted by a residential school. You could imagine the loss of human potential. When we look at all the brilliant people that were like beaten down, whether or not they were sexually abused, physically abused, spiritually abused, and then later having to self-medicate, we have lost so much human potential. But as an Indigenous person, every one of us has either sisters or grandparents, aunties or uncles, or somebody that has been to residential school. You have to remember that within British Columbia, the last residential school closed in 1979. So it's not that far away. It's very recent. Also, the impacts and effects of residential school are still happening today. It's not something that is historical. It's still happening today. So we've absolutely all been impacted by residential school.
Yeah. So when did this all start taking place?
In Canada, it was a policy that the first Prime Minister, John A. Macdonald, instituted a bill that around the 1870s that then spurred on the Residential School Act. So you could see how many, generation after generation was actually impacted, because the intent of that was to assimilate the Indigenous person. In fact, later, a few years later, Duncan Campbell Scott who was the superintendent, the chief superintendent of basically like the Bureau of Indian Affairs in the States, said, you know, that basically they were not going to be happy until every Indigenous person was absorbed into the body politic. Also stated, you know, what their intent was, to kill the savage and save the child. So it was a methodical, thought-out process to assimilate and get rid of, as they called it, the Indian problem.
Yeah. And it sounds like only some children were taken out. I mean, how was it determined that some children were taken from the home and others were left at the home?
No. It was
all children.
Because it was statute that if you were going to, that you had to let your children go to residential school. That was the law. So what some parents did is that they hid their children. My parents never went to residential school because they were brought to the mountains. Whenever the Indian agent came, and they actually, it was forced. So the RCMP or the Mounties would come in and take the children. So for the most part, one of the elders said to us, could you imagine a whole village without hearing the laughter of children? I think that's why we did the film, is to actually show that our whole society, the ways of being, our principles, our values, is all centered around taking care of children. So when you remove the children from the community, you know, there's a loss of roles, there's a loss of purpose, and there's just the actual heartbreak. Everything we do is for love of our children, and that's why we called the film For Love. So you look at all of the atrocities that happened, and so they were going to target our most vulnerable, which is our babies, and take them out of community. So, of course, it's going to have those intergenerational impacts that we still see today and we're still feeling.
Yeah. So have these Indigenous people been able to preserve their culture despite what happened? I mean, I see that now it sounds like a lot of effort is being made to reteach them their original language, their original cultures, their things like that.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that the film really showcases the resurgence of our culture. And I wouldn't say that everything was lost. It was weakened. The reason that we're still here to say that we're Indigenous, the reason that I can still say I'm Gixxen and Carrier, is because of that resilience and that spirit that we have as Indigenous people. You know, you could do whatever you want to do to us, but we're always going to prevail. We're forever people, as my mom would say. And so I think there is the beauty that we wanted to show in the film was really our culture and our practices, and that we're always going to be here. Matt, did you want to say anything to that?
On top of all that, the main thing was really just to follow what is happening right now, and a true testament to the work that Mary's been doing, and also one of our other executive producers, Cindy Blackstock, in watching the big shift and watching that, you know, if you love your children and you can provide everything that's necessary, there's a massive shift. And, you know, I, for one, am happy to start seeing some of the positive shifts. We can't forget the past, but this is one thing that we really, really, really wanted to showcase, is that through culture, it is really one of the best ways to really revitalize and to move forward.
Yeah. Matt, how did you get involved in the film as director?
Well, Mary and I had worked on Highway of Tears together, which was on Netflix. And, through that whole process, through the end of filming into pushing the film across Canada and also across the world, we obviously developed quite a strong friendship. And through that friendship, I really started to learn, you know, the ins and outs of the day-to-day of what Mary does, you know, from the moment she wakes up to the moment she goes to sleep, in terms of fighting, you know, not only for her people, but all First Nations, Métis, and Inuit people, but also especially children. And, you know, through that, we really started to talk about what was necessary and what people really didn't know, because I think we're starting to see a shift, and I say the global pop culture, in terms of people realizing the history of Indigenous populations, not just in North America but across the world. And I think that was something that was really important, and I know through our conversations with Mary that it was something important for us, you know, as friends also to share. And to make sure that others can understand some of these root causes that were never taught before.
Yeah. Mary, what's the government's reaction been to the film? I mean, there was definitely a scene there where a government official addresses, I believe, the Senate in a native language. I'm not really sure what he says, but it's obvious that he apologizes and does kind of tear up.
Well, I think there is, there has been a movement of late, more so in the last few years, you know, to try to right the wrongs of the past. In fact, you know, with Canada accepting the United Nations Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous People and putting that into an act was, you know, a huge step forward. I think the sentiment we're hearing outside of everywhere is that they want to reconcile, and they just really need to be held to that. In Canada, I don't know if you know this, but there's one of the largest claims in Canadian history for $40 billion to be paid to children and families that have been discriminated against by Canada within the child welfare system. And so there's things like that that's happening. But I think the film really is opening eyes to not just government officials, but just to Canadian citizens. I think a lot of people did not know the extent and why things are happening the way they are now. You know, people like, see my people on the street and, you know, suffering, homeless. And they're like, oh, well, that's just because they're lazy. You hear all these stereotypes. But no, this film really sheds light onto the multi-generational trauma that has been inflicted on my people for the sake of genocide. And so obviously there's going to be people that are still hurting, and more so in some cases. So I think just the general population are finally understanding. And I think when we look at the having Matt come on the film, and I think this is something that was really important. Like, I wanted Matt to be on this film because he is a non-Indigenous man. And so oftentimes when we're making the film, I know so much about this issue. I live it. I am Indigenous. So it was really good for Matt to be outside and say, well, Mary, like, non-Indigenous people don't know that. So it was really good to see the film from his eyes so that we can educate more non-Indigenous people, not only in Canada, but across the world.
Okay. It's the screening is this Thursday, 7 p.m. I'm out of time, but thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Again, that'll be held at the Jim Santee Auditorium. Tickets are free. You can find out more at parkcityfilm.org. It's KPCW Park City.